we're in an age right now with all the, you know, the electronics and YouTubes, and mm-hmm. it seems like every 6 months something new comes on the market, and that here in the Hollywood area, there's so many talented people that were involved in special effects and in creating things. And now their jobs are wiped out because it's all done with computer-generated mm-hmm. graphics. CGI, and so I hope the magician can stay ahead of the curve there.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Now that my six-part series from the Magic Castle is over, I have one more special podcast to give you. You might consider this an epilogue to the series. Before I travel to Los Angeles, I called in advance to set an appointment with one of Magic's most important legendary figures, John Gaughan. For those of you who may be new to Magic and unfamiliar with John, this podcast will be full of stories that will give you a great perspective and a background of this most interesting man. But briefly, he is a woodworker and builder of stage illusions that have been used by Mark Wilson, Doug Henning, Siegfried and Roy, Simon Drake, Chris Angel, and so many, many more international stars of magic. He was the one who built flying for David Copperfield. He has also built, repaired, and rebuilt some automatons like the Turk, the chess-playing automaton, Psycho, Antonio Diablo, and some illusions originally built and owned by Jean-Eugène Robert Houdin. If you visit our website at themagicwordpodcast.com, then you can see some of the photos from his workshop and collection, and also view some videos that I recorded during our visit. So, let's enter a world of enchantment as we sit in Johnny's drawing room surrounded by his collection and spend some time chatting with the world's foremost illusion builder as we enjoy the chamber music softly wafting in the background here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for themagicwordpodcast.com, and in response to one of the listeners some time ago who had said, if you ever get a chance to talk to John Gaughan, you need to set up an interview. And whenever I came out to the Magic Castle to work, I contacted John in advance, and he was gracious enough to say, yep, come on down. And I thought, well, I'm going to be going and visiting his home. Well, I guess in a way it is. It's your workshop, which is your home, from home.
So hang out.
Here we are with John Gaughan. Thank you, John. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for coming over, Scott.
Well, thank you so very much for your hospitality and let me come in here and seeing your secret den inside over here. We were just starting to talk, as I walked in, the first thing I see is a Turk, and we were just starting to talk about that, and I thought I better turn on the microphone over here. So you said also in your library that you have a good library that goes back to like the 1700s,
I guess. Yes, and it's so interesting to run into a person like you that has an interest in it, because for many years I've been working rebuilding the Turk over here,
and
no one really kind of understood what it was or anything.
I still have goosebumps every time I glance over your shoulder here. It is incredible. Because, now, the original, I thought, burned in a fire in World's Fair or something, right?
They burned in the fire in Philadelphia in 1854, yes.
Okay, completely. So it was gone, so you had to rebuild one? I mean, it wasn't like you took the remains or the scraps of that. And
no, there was one piece that was that survived. It was back in Dr. Mitchell's office, the guy that kind of, you might say, owned it, because he had given it to the Chinese Museum in Philadelphia when the chess club there was really, they lost interest in it. So it sat over there, it really in a back room for many, many years until it burned in the fire. Mm-hmm. And the Philadelphia Library Company has a wonderful a strong library on the chess player, if any of you ever go within there. By the way, is that music bothering
you? No, not at all. In fact, this would be the music I'd be listening to in the radio. I love classical music, so it's very nice. Okay. I feel like I'm being serenaded to in a chamber here. So, I feel like Dick Hatch and Rosemary, you know, are here playing their chamber music for me over here. So this was rebuilt almost then completely from scratch. I mean, you got all the work and so.
Yeah, it's, of course, you're building it from engravings. There's been over 800 different books and articles, three plays, and this three movies also on this thing, and no one ever really got how it really worked. They kind of finished the book saying, well, somebody's inside and they move around.
And that was it.
That's how
they always talk about how that they open up one side and you see all the gears, and then they open up the other side and you see the gears, and so there's no apparent person inside there, you know, so the illusion is complete.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I'm a weak chess player, but, you know, it's always been in the early Magic books that we've had in our libraries, and, yeah, how in the hell did that thing work? Mm-hmm. And it turned out that Kempelen was an amateur magician, and they actually had found some magic effects in his possession when after he died. And so the principles involved in this thing really weren't thought to be invented, let's say, until 100 years later. And it's just amazing how the thing works. And we take it to robotic seminars and the Chess Federation playoffs and all that stuff, and just for demonstration purposes, and it still fools everyone.
Yeah, well, I could imagine it would. I mean, I've not looked at this closely. I want to take a picture here shortly with it, but just from reading about it, it sounded like it fooled all the royalty of the world, you know, and traveled about. You know, apparently the guy who was in there was a master chess player before his time, and so he couldn't be beat.
that's true, and I think a lot of the people that played it, of course, were intimidated by the look of the machine and the sound of it, because it has wonderful
whirring noises.
The gears and just the...
Well, speaking then of automatons, that you have built and rebuilt several others from Houdon's originals, I guess.
Yeah,
and things like that.
Right behind you there.
Oh, okay.
That's Antonio.
Antonio.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And was that... This wasn't something that you completely rebuilt, or rather built from scratch. This was something you rebuilt, I guess, that had been owned by him.
Just restored it more than anything.
I've seen pictures of you with this, like at the... history conference, conference on history of magic.
Yeah,
L&LA,
right.
with this, where you've demonstrated that.
That's true.
And now, how long did it take you? It seemed like it was years to put that.
Well, I remember when I took it apart for the first time, just to kind of see how it worked and all of that. And there, stamped inside there, was Robert Houdon, Paris. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is really special. So I carefully closed it back up. And I contacted Jacques Barnier in Paris, and he helped me figure out what the routine was that the little puppet did. And so it took about 6 years to get it back really running properly.
Mm-hmm. And there again, you didn't have blueprints, I guess, like you did with the Turk, but this was something you just kind of intuitively knew that it was going to have this gear or something in order to make it work?
Well, of course... Most of the pieces were there. Well, I shouldn't say that, because the whole control thing had to be built. But you just kind of reverse engineered the thing, and you know, if it's, you see how he swings around on a trapeze bar, and then you try to make a crank handle that makes him do that. But it was trying to find out what the routine was, because it was written down in the libraries over there, and Jacques and his buddies got all that stuff for me over the years, and lo and behold, there it is.
Now, do you have to wind it up, I mean, just to kind of keep the gears running every once in a while? It's kind of like having a vintage car. You'd have to get out and run it every once in a while, I think.
Well, it's much worse than that. It's kind of like a helicopter, you know. It's 2 hours of maintenance for every hour you fly it. And this thing, we did it at the Magic Castle for a week, 21 performances, and it really takes a lot of time to, you know, keep it up and running. And after two or three shows, you have to go back in there and tweak it up. But it's still doing it. We're actually going to perform it, let's see, in October at Richard Kaufman's Genie Convention in Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
So looking forward to that.
Very good. Now, also, the movie Hugo had an automaton. Was that built by you? You know which one I'm talking about?
Oh, yes. Yeah. That was built in, actually, it was in Scotland. The people did that. And that was actually 15 different automatons.
Oh.
And just to, because they had one that he carried, and one that was thrown down on the railroad tracks, and one that did the riding. And so rather than having one do everything, mm-hmm. it's a lot easier for those film guys to...
Right. Piece it all together. It's kind of a part of the movie magic. You know, in fact, I remember that in Goldfinger, the car, the Aston Martin, the James Bond drove, he had several of them, because there isn't one car that could have the bulletproof screen that came from the back and shooting oil and the machine guns and the ejector seat and all that kind of stuff. And so I saw that car on display one time at a shopping mall, and they said this was one of six, I think, that was being used in the movies. Anyhow, so I can imagine that they probably would have. Now, this one that I see kind of in front of me over here, this is... What?
That's the Android clarinetist. That really wasn't any magician's performance, but it is very magical. It was built in the Netherlands in 1838, and the man, the family, the Van Achelen family, were a family of church organ builders, mm-hmm. and they were fascinated with Vaucanson's duck, the automaton, from... the 1700s and early 1800s, and so they wanted to make a figure that would actually play a music instrument rather than just the music coming out of his chest. So they made this clarinetist here, and his fingers, as you can kind of see there, mm-hmm. they're articulated up and down and back and forth. And so he has a 32-note chromatic scale, and he plays very complicated things by Beethoven and Von Weber. And I'm still working on him, but it's all functioning. It's just the clarinet itself still needs a lot of work.
But he has a diaphragm, so the clarinet comes up to his mouth and actually blows through that? So.
Well, it looks like it does, okay. But... that's part of the illusion in that the air from the bellows goes down a rubber hoses down the arms and out through the thumbs into the instrument.
So
you do not have to make up the right embouchure to the mouthpiece, because that's very delicate in a clarinet.
And over in the corner, then that's Diablo?
Psycho. Yes, uh-huh. They belong to Harry Keller. And there's a picture on the wall of Keller giving it to Houdini in 1919.
And did Houdini travel with it, or he just put it in his...
No, he just... He was very interested in mechanical things and automata. And so it was... you know, after he wrote the Unmasking, he was always trying to collect all sorts of mechanical... things, and Psycho was a wonderful piece.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of fell into disrepair as well, and then you fixed it up?
It was up in the Houdini Museum in Canada for many, many years, and so I had built some things for him up there, and it really didn't have anything to do with Houdini's performance, so I traded them some work for the piece, and I also duplicated it exactly so that when I took it out of the museum, I could put the duplicate in its place so nothing would be missing looking. Mm-hmm. Of course, it doesn't function, the one I made, but at least it kept everyone there happy.
And this other one that's back over in the opposite corner over there is that some...
That was just in a department store window around 1915 in Paris, and it's just what's called a trade stimulator. It goes over and over doing a cup and balls magic trick.
Through the table kind of a thing?
Yes.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Gotcha. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So let me ask an obvious question about how that you go about acquiring these different items. Are the things that you trade, you buy, you find, do people tell you about them, or how do you... They're all interesting stories, I'm sure.
Yeah, Scott, it's all of those things, because I do a lot of horse trading, and we all do that in the collecting world. And so,
good point. I don't think everybody can appreciate what collectors actually do. That I know whenever I first got into collecting posters, and I wanted to buy someone's poster. I was talking to Nick Ruggiero. So I like this poster. He said, "Well, I'll trade it for you."
Yeah.
And I thought, okay. So that's why I started getting the idea that that's what you're doing. You know.
Yes.
We want to keep kind of the same sum total of what we got. We might trade a little bit, so that way we can kind of get something we've been looking for.
You know? That's true. Yeah. You can't have everything, even though you want it.
Even but, if you're Jay Marshall. I don't want much. I want it all.
Yeah, but upgrade or, you know, yeah. when you do the trading. And so there's, of course, a lot of book guys, they're always looking for a better copy of what they have.
Sure.
So.
Original copy or first edition or something, sure. Yeah. Well, I know that Ken Klosterman was starting to move some of his collection. I think he was finally saying, okay, well, I've kind of had it all long enough, and I think I want to put it over into someone else's hands. So a little at a time, sometimes collectors will want to, because what made me think of that, of course, is your cup and or ball and vase collection. I'm thinking of Ken's down in his basement then also. A little at a time, at some point, you start thinking, well, I want to kind of keep the collection together. So you're not looking at trading, but perhaps giving it or selling it to somebody else who you know it'll be in good hands, I guess. So.
Well, that's true, and I haven't come to that point just yet, but it's crossed my mind. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of cups and balls there, as you can see, but it took a lot more of them to get that because I did trade, of course, back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Anyone in particular that of those ball and vases that you perhaps most valuable to you because of a certain reason? Let's say because of what you had to trade for it or how hard it was in order to acquire it? Or
no, there's pieces in there that I went after, you know, I tried to get for many, many years, and so they're valuable in that respect.
Right.
But and there's one or two pieces in there that I actually made. So not that they're any value to me, but I appreciate wood turning so much, and I've always been a wood turner, so it's so interesting to think all of those things do a magic trick, and that's what really drew me to these old pieces that somebody would go to that much trouble to build something just for a magic trick.
Just for a trick.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you first were inspired how young?
Oh, you know, I used to do birthday parties around the neighborhood when I was 8 or 10 years old,
mm-hmm.
and I started working for Mark Wilson in Dallas when I was 14, so, mm-hmm. And I came out here to Los Angeles when I was 21.
And you started your own business at that time? Or
no,
were you
I was working. Mark had his television series, The Magic Land of Alakazam, and so I was just kind of a helper, gopher type of guy that used to love to work with his hands. So
mm-hmm. You were kind of making some of the props and things then at the time?
Well, I would... We would modify them and repaint them to match some of the storylines in there, but
right.
But Carl Owen and Owen Magic was really the main
builder for him at the time.
Okay, and so it was wonderful working alongside Carl Owen back then in the early '60s.
Mm-hmm.
He had a great work ethic and wonderful sense of humor.
Any stories you say like a wonderful sense of humor or something that comes to mind?
Oh, not off the top of my head, but it's just in order to get through 8 hours in a wood shop, you know, you gotta
have a little bit of fun, but not so much that you lose focus and you cut off a thumb or something.
That's true.
Now, was it Owen who had built the train that was the that separate the sawing?
Oh no, I built that.
Okay.
Yeah, uh-huh. That was
An interesting story that Mark had told. I think I've heard in his lecture him tell several times about that he couldn't do a sawing because of
saws.
Yeah, you want to go ahead and tell the story?
Well,
how this came about?
Yeah, on the Magic Land of Alakazam, they didn't want to. Of course, there's children's watching it, so they didn't want to have any knives or saws or hangmans or anything like that in there. But yet, some of the classics of magic. You have to kind of, you want to do, and sawing a woman in two, of course, is one of them. So we built a train for Nani, and to where she was just divided in two. And, you know, there's no sawing or anything. Just blades were put in as dividers, not to cut or anything.
Right. Essentially, that was what happened, but it wasn't presented as if that she was being cut
right
in half. And then they were on rails, and they moved her apart.
Yeah, uh-huh, like yeah. And Rebo, the clown, yeah, who was down, he came from a little above Houston down there, down in Baytown.
Well, he was down, yeah, Baytown, yeah, he was in Galveston. And, yeah, him and Doug Carnegie and Gene DeGene were the three guys that kind of hung out together. And down in Galveston and Baytown, they were best. Doug Carnegie just passed away a few weeks ago.
Oh.
So, Gene died a few years ago, but Bev's still doing well, obviously,
yep.
So great guy. Uh-huh. Now, as far as who came up with the idea, was that a joint effort with that?
Oh, you mean the train?
On the train, yeah.
Well, it was. I think it was mostly Mark, and but Mark was surrounded by a lot of great magic minds for Alakazam, and you know, of course, Bev was there, and Bob Fenton, Bob Towner, and Leo Benke, and like I say, I was just kind of a
gopher and painter.
And my magic background was very weak because, you know, these guys, especially Bob Fenton, had been two world tours with Virgil around the world. And those guys had seen everything.
Yeah. You were in the right place at the right time to kind of learn from these guys.
Oh, gosh,
also,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I was.
You just never know, you know, at the time that you were in the epicenter of what became what it is now.
Yeah, the center of the universe.
So to speak. Now, as far as the building things, obviously that you have built stuff for a ton of people who are well-known magic celebrities and those who are lesser-known but are doing very well and making stuff. Do they come to you with an idea, with a plan? Do you then work it out and say, well, we'll have to make this a different size or whatever? But do they have the general idea a lot of times when they come to you to have an illusion built?
Well, of course, they know what fits their style.
Right.
And also, the illusion that they want can't you know, work in your living room and work in the center of a football field. So you have to.
Yeah, Franz Ferrari versus Fred Capps. I mean, they're two different styles.
You're right. You got to. I always say you have to define your audience first, and then you build to your audience, and so the staging and the sight lines and all that. So, and it's a lot like as Siegfried would say, you have to. It's like building, making a suit of clothes. There's a lot of fitting and a lot of give and take and compromise. So,
good point.
It takes more time than you think.
Now, in the case of Doug Henning, I assume that you built a lot of the illusions that he used on television.
Yes.
And it fit his style at the time in the 60s and very bright and colorful with clouds and psychedelic colors and everything like that. And I know that he had a good magic mind. Did he come to you again with these kinds of ideas and said, I want something that's going to look good on TV or that I can tour with or be on a Broadway show? Or?
Well, yeah. Of course, I built all of Doug's shows except the first television special. And he was wonderful to work with, of course.
Any good story? Tell me a story about Doug.
Well, gosh, there's so many different versions of it. He and Debbie. It was interesting because they both were the same size, and they both could wear each other's clothes.
That's kind of unique.
And she used to double for him sometimes, and. You know, fitting him through a jerk tube or fitting her into the illusions was very easy to do.
I had met him once backstage, and I remember shaking hands, and I thought he was kind of a diminutive man. I assume he must have been about the size of Houdini. Well, Houdini, I guess, so from the pictures I've seen, was really more bulked up, and he worked out and had a bigger torso, I guess, you know, with muscles, but I wouldn't say that Doug was necessarily like that. More like a swimmer's body or something,
yes,
I guess, you know.
Lift.
Yeah. Now, some of the other guys that you work with, like in Siegfried and Roy, whenever that they've got their massive illusions on stage, now, do you go and build them there, or do you build them here and ship them in parts, or how does that work?
No, they're built down here in my shop, and then they're taken up there for fittings and rehearsals and that sort of thing. And again, that's a lot of back and forth, and because a lot of them involve their animals,
right.
So those guys are, those animals are very, very strong. So,
yeah, so you have to build them almost like cages so they can't break through.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It has to be easy enough so they can access the panel, I guess, but not so easy that they can break through prematurely.
Right, yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. They just, they really have to be built strong.
Now, of course, that their reign in Las Vegas ended prematurely with Roy getting bitten, but did they talk with you about some ideas of how they wanted the show to evolve, or were you working on any new illusions at the time before they ended?
Well, Siegfried was the magic guy, and Roy, of course, was the animal guy.
Yeah.
So, and Siegfried still has a great magic mind, and mm-hmm. And there was so much cleverness in that show that he really didn't get credit for because there's principles there and his combination of different routines was very, very impressive. And I hope someday he writes a book on that show.
Well, they have that big, massive tome. It was like $600 or something that came to you with white gloves, you know,
talking about that you can
open. It talked about kind of the history of all that. So it would be nice if there was something that was, you know, more in the price range of the average magician to buy to learn about.
I don't have that book, by the way. So,
okay. But you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Yeah, it was a limited number of
those. I saw it one time, yes.
Yeah. I've seen it on auction a time or two then as well. One thing, when I set up our time to get together, was a question that I have been wanting to ask you for a long time, having to do with what makes for a good illusion. And I'm talking about not necessarily like a close-up illusion, but something, again, like what you build. Is it something that, well, I'm not going to put words in your mouth. What is it that makes for a good illusion?
Well, you mean like a good close-up illusion or a stage illusion?
Stage illusion. Stage illusion in particular, yeah.
Well, I think one that that doesn't compromise very much. I mean, as far as lighting and staging the audience, and the origami immediately comes to mind that Jim Steinmeier developed, and we finally got it to where, you know, you can do it surrounded, and you can do it. It is one you can literally do in your living room, mm-hmm. and do it outside or. Mm-hmm. Or just about anywhere, mm-hmm. And still it's effective and a fooler.
Yeah, that was like the zigzag after that had come out. That certainly could be spun around and put in the middle of bright light anywhere.
Yes,
whether you're on a cruise ship or the back of a big rig trailer or something in a state fair or whatever, performing you do that way. So yeah, I would think that something that you could do in bright lights, any light in any stage, and completely surrounded would be the best kind of illusion.
Yes.
There are very few, I think, you can actually do like that, though.
That's true, and it's something you can fold up and put in the back seat of your car.
Right. Well, and that's the other advantage. Yeah, pack flat and big then, obviously, then too. Well, the follow-up question, I guess, would be then what has been one, not necessarily that would fall in that category, but one that you have found as being the best illusion, which may have involved black art or something. I've got something in mind I'll bring up in a minute, but what has been one of your favorite illusions, not including automatons?
Boy.
I mean, it's like asking what's your favorite child, I know. But
I know. It's, and, you know, it always seems to be the last thing we worked on. And the last big illusion we built, actually performed it at the castle. It was the levitation called Astarte, where the girl floats up in the air and spins all around and goes all over the stage. And Herman and Keller and a lot of the great 19th century magicians performed this thing. Mm-hmm. And so we resurrected it. And for some reason, it went out of favor around the turn of the century, and no one did it after that. So
was the hookup just too difficult, and that was why?
There was a lot of equipment to it, and I don't know, maybe it got overused. Mm-hmm. It's hard to tell.
At that time?
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
And then it kind of just disappeared?
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh. So now we kind of have brought that thing back, but there's so much parts and pieces to it to perform, and it takes people and
right
you know, a lot of energy.
See, the one that comes to my mind I think would be beautiful that I haven't seen would be Pepper's Ghost. It seems like, again, that yes. was at the history conference uh-huh. that I had read about, where that I think Mike Cavney presented some time ago, or I think you may have been involved, obviously, with that one. For those people who don't know about that, do you want to explain that, how not yeah. necessarily how it works, but the illusion?
Well, the Pepper's Ghost is another one just like it. Yeah, a great 19th century illusion. That takes a lot of stage preparation, and the presentation of it is such the lighting has to be just right, mm-hmm. and it's,
the audience in a particular position, yeah. yeah.
And it's more of a story, a little vignette that a playlet, and the ones that we built for our conference. Yes, I built the thing here in the shop, and it was a. In fact, they actually put it, A&E did a television special on it about 10 years ago, 12 years ago maybe. And it's beautiful to see the glass, because we all know how it works. It's always been in all the Golston, you know, all the logbooks or everything, mm-hmm. where... this rolling piece of glass divides the room silently, and the reflections change in there, and it's just like magic should be.
Yeah, it was kind of like the old thing, girl to gorilla, I guess. That yes, it was at the, in yes. the carnival or something, in which the light would be on her, and then it would be uh-huh. focused on. The gorilla or something. Yeah. It looked like it just transitioned from one to another.
That's
kind of
true.
Thing. Yeah. So I just find that to be a fascinating illusion, certainly, and one that involves an incredible amount of work and assistance and a lot of big props and things.
You know? Yes. Uh-huh. You wonder how people like Keller and Herman trooped with something like that.
Right.
Because it's a huge piece of glass. And
mm-hmm. very delicate.
Yeah.
yeah. Mm-hmm. Particularly back then when the roads were pretty rocky, I would imagine, and trying to move it around. It
yes.
And by train and everything
train,
else.
Yes. Mm-hmm,
the way that they would.
But I understand that the labor and was inexpensive. Mm-hmm. It was the materials that were really expensive in building
right.
things.
Now, in Maskelyne's theater in London... Was
Egyptian
Hall. That's what I'm trying yeah. to say. Now that would have been ideal because you've got just a place, and you can continue to do different illusions. You know,
yes, build into it. It's kind of like Siegfried and Roy had
exactly.
Yeah, you stay in the same place, and you can
tweak
it though where you want it.
Right, and that was why I was asking if you build things there or build them here. So you build them in pieces and ship them there, and then you go there and put them together for them. I guess.
Yes. Yeah. Of course.
Yeah. So. Obviously, Jeff's out here. You just introduced me, and he's still building things. You're working things. You've got new things in mind or things you're working on all the time and the backlog of orders.
Yeah, we're building things for, we're working on levitations for Kabuki Theater in Tokyo, mm-hmm. and it's all the way to, a lot of these... animatronic, show-controlled, electronic things that they're really beyond my capacity to control. They have servos inside that move things around.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the direction magic is going in nowadays.
It seems to be. A lot of things that are very intricate with computer-generated types of controls or, like you said, you know, microcontrols or something
yes.
that's going to be inside computerized mm-hmm. and things. And that's the thing, then again, as well, that I think is organic about going back to, let's say, the ball in the vase, that it's not something that is contrived such that people are thinking that it is computer-generated. Because people are becoming more sophisticated now, understanding technology. So whenever you, for an example, do a trick using an iPhone or something, they'll say, well, where'd you get that app? It wasn't like, hey, that was a really good trick, or how'd you do that? It was like, how did your phone, where can I get that? You know, kind of a thing. And so people, I think, are more jaded in there. That's why magicians have to be on the front of the curve to kind of
yeah.
Try to show something that no one else can even have a clue of how that's done.
Yeah.
But the mind immediately now jumps to the technology saying, well, it can't be done by any other means except some sort of computer thing. For an example, just in my show I'm doing at the Castle this week, I'm doing magnetized cards. And in my presentation, I'm having people look at these cards, inspect the cards, make sure there's nothing sticky on them, and then I have them look at my hands, let them feel my hands, make sure there's nothing tacky or waxy or anything sticky or under my skin or embedded in my bones or anything like that. And then after I flowed the cards, that's my final thing. There was a doctor last night who said that was the most amazing. Could you mind if I inspect your hands? He said, I want to see if there was a magnet, actually. He said, you don't have one in there, but I want to see if you really do. And he was feeling my hands. He really thought that I had a magnet. I mean, that was his logical explanation, you know, of how the things must be done. So anyhow, you're right that with a lot of technology today that people, I think, will jump to that next conclusion. Are there some new things that you're working on then right now that involve some computer-generated types of things or that will require a computer to make the thing work? Or
yes, there's... Well, I'm looking across the room here. There's a French table over there made by the builder of Vauxhall, and it was called the Shower of Gold, and it's a beautiful poetic thing where you take coins and you toss them in the air from 20 feet away from the table, and the coins disappear and turn into kind of a metallic star thing into it, and you hear the coins fall into there. And it was done by an assistant off stage, pulling strings, of course, to a slightly mechanical table. But nowadays, the requester, they want it all completely animated, to where they just have to push a button in their pocket to make it do all of these
things. The electronics, so that's why it's almost like a Bluetooth or something.
Yes, and, and the servos involved, but the controlling of it and the speed of this doing that and... It's amazing what's out there on the market that is available to do this stuff.
And now, do some of your things, like going back to automatons, go on tour, like to exhibit in museums, so this way people can kind of see the inner workings? For an example, as we came in first, you were showing me the Josephi's rising cards.
It was
phenomenal. It looks like a carousel of some sort under the table then, and off stage, you would kind of dial this thing to whatever card, and it would rotate around, and then that card would rise up. That, I think, the real trick of that is the mechanics of it. I mean, the trick itself is fantastic, if given the right presentation, certainly. But I think the mechanics of that would be something that, in a museum exhibit, people would like to see the inner workings. Has there been any kind of a tour that you have let some things out or seen that kind of thing?
No, and also, you kind of... To me, the pure magic and the craftsmanship is, that's why I like to show people the inner workings of the thing, but not the public, because you still want the magic to
Very good point. To
be there.
Then you become the mass magician, I guess. Yeah, you're showing what's behind.
Yeah.
And that's part of what I think magic is all about, is that if people think that there is some contrivance going on, then they can catch you out, and then it's not magic. Then it just becomes a puzzle.
Yes, and then if your audience knows that it's some sort of a simple trick or something like that, then they take that principle and they apply it to a lot of magic, which took a lot more skill, let's
say. That's right.
And, but the
and in many cases, they can be completely wrong in that.
Of course, they usually are wrong, But the man that made the card rise in there, Josephi, made that in 1906, and... It's just the mind that came up with that, and the same guy that designed it built it. The craftsman and the designer should always be the same. And then he performed it also. Mm-hmm. So the skull over there—that's Balsamo. He also built that. And
the talking skull.
Yes. Uh huh. And all these things are just unbelievable. How much mechanics are inside that thing just to do a trick where the next magician, or Josephi, saw a guy doing the talking skull where it just clacks to give the number of the card, and his head turns a little, And he was, the guy was probably doing it with a thread.
Like a wrapping hand
thing. Yeah, uh-huh. And so Giuseppe goes back to his shop, and 6 months later, he's built it into a clockwork thing. So that's his way of doing it.
You know, years ago, and this would have been 17, 1800s, that people were coming up with these kinds of ideas that were clockmakers in their background, it seemed like, first. And then they kind of built things to do magic, and then they did a magic show and everything of it. I don't see nor hear about many people today who are doing that kind of thing or have that kind of mind to come up with these kinds of ideas. That so you know you're building things from the rebuilding things from the past, but are there any or many people that you know of today who have the minds for building these kinds of things that some of the magicians and clockmakers had centuries ago?
Well,
or is that lost?
I think it, to get the same man to be the performer and the builder and the is rare, but the magicians nowadays are in my mind quite smart, bright, and they don't either have the time or the craftsmanship to do it, but they know how to find it. Mm-hmm. And they know what they want. Mm-hmm. So you see a lot of wonderful things at the Magic Castle where mm-hmm. you are mm-hmm. that new innovative ideas that they're working on and trying out.
Well, you know, I was talking with Mark Kalin about this very thing, about how that he said, I can do a little bit of everything, whether it's advertising, and Ginger could do some choreography, I can do the building, and et cetera, and the marketing and advertising for the show, et cetera. But really, I'm best if I were to farm those things out and let this guy build this, this person put together my advertising, someone else build my website, so this way that you're not spread too thin. So that was some of the best advice I've heard from a magician, in which that you can still oversee these kinds of things, which is kind of what a CEO of a company should be doing anyhow. And you are your own CEO if you're working for yourself. And you should have people like you who are going to be building things and saying, look, I've got an idea for something. Is this possible? Can this be built? And how can this be tweaked, customized, going back to what we said then earlier then too?
Yeah. Well, even in my job of building these things, we farm out different parts of it too. Whether it's
not everything is all built here.
No, it's because you can very, very quickly get bogged down and stop the whole production just because you're trying to figure out one thing. So we have real fine machining done at a machine shop because they can do it so much faster and quicker, and we have the part back the next day, and so it just keeps the flow of things going. We have all the machinery that can do this stuff, but it's better to just stand back and try to control the flow of the project and get the big picture going.
Right.
It's very rewarding to be able to go out there and pick up some, say, I made this, and put it on the shelf, but you gotta pay the rent, so you gotta keep it.
Gotta keep moving. If you spend too much time, you're gonna have to charge a lot more for that item, and not everybody's gonna be wanting to pay that.
Right.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so, again, there are some things that you're continuing to work on then right now. It sounds like you were talking about something then that's going to be for a kabuki theater over in Tokyo. I assume that you do a lot of traveling, and so I'm fortunate that you happen to be in town the time I'm here.
Well,
you probably spent a lot of time out of the country.
Yeah, in the kabuki theater, that hundreds of year old tradition, so you don't want to mess with it, so to speak. You want to keep the tradition just right, and so... we were very successful into having the actors, kabuki actors, levitate and float around in this production, and keeping the tradition of it. And all the reviews of it in the paper were very good, because the kabuki actor's father thought that his son was going to ruin the theater by bringing on all this Vegas trickery.
Yes, right, right. Have you ever built something and after a certain point saying, this is not going to work, got to scrap it?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anything come to mind?
Oh, table bases. I like to make the things look small. And I've made the things all the way to the finish end of it and say, well, how did I let it get this far? This looks terrible. you know, and we just start over again.
That's got to feel horrible. I mean, in other words, you're creating something. It's like a baby, and then it's like, oh, man, this is not going to grow
properly.
Well, but
it makes you think twice. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You learn from your mistakes.
Of course.
Yeah. And what has been something that has you thought was going to take a lot of time to make, but ended up being a little bit shorter, and vice versa? You thought maybe this won't take long. Sure, I can make this for you. Before long, you've got a year into it or something. Have there been some things like that?
Well, just about everything takes longer than you think.
Than you think, okay.
Yeah, even though you've made it a bunch of times before.
Uh-huh.
And
so you don't mass produce things then necessarily. You do like one at a time.
One at a time, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and origamis we've made a couple at a time, but I like to kind of start over and change them around as we do it. So,
now, what do you think? Whenever that you're making these illusions, and also as far as the legality of it, I mean, I know that what you're doing would be where that you have the authorization by the builder. Let's say who's come up, like Jim Steinmeier's. Wasn't Jim the one who invented the origami, for an example?
Yes.
And so, okay, you have the rights to do that. I know there are people who don't have the rights, don't have the plans, they've measured it or whatever. And that's happened for generations. I think Keller had Valentin, or who was it that I think had worked for him, who had measured it. And then he left one guy and worked for somebody else.
They
steal ideas and different things, you know, like that. You know, I work with Walter Blaney way back when with the World Alliance Magicians, which we were trying to protect these secrets, I guess, basically.
Uh-huh.
What are your thoughts on copywriting or, you know, proprietary ownership of intellectual property?
Well, of course, especially with the magicians, it's always been very difficult. And I don't know what the answer is, if there is an answer.
You can't patent it, because if you do, then it's going to be in public domain.
Yeah, and I actually do have patents on several things, but that's only to protect the people I'm building.
Like flying? Flying is a protection.
Yes, uh-huh. And but there's other stage effects that, you know, when you're coming up with a play, for instance,
mm-hmm.
and
like Beauty and the Beast, I know Jim was working on.
In fact, the levitation in that thing was totally different than anything that had been built before,
mm-hmm.
and so, but there was nothing in there that was that we patented, but. Along the line, the producers of the show sometimes wants to make sure that what is going to be in the show is protected.
Mm-hmm.
So you're kind of forced to do that.
What kind of problems have you ever encountered? Have you ever actually gone to court or had some sort of dispute over something?
Oh, there have been disputes, but never in a court setting.
Okay. It's just been something in which that you've kind of tried to settle out of court, or that we agree to disagree.
It gets settled, yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. But you hear about all sorts of disagreements along that line, and you know, and especially in Europe, in America, they see things a little differently.
That's true, and in China, for an example, in which that they, I understand, like I wasn't at the FISM in Beijing, but I'd heard that there were people who were like selling delights that were ripoffs, and they were kicked out of the dealer's room and came back the next day, and they were selling them someplace else in the dealer's room that were not authorized at all. You know, those kinds of things. It's just like DVDs being ripped off over there from movies or whatever in Hollywood that they get or whatever.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah, I don't. I
different.
Different approach to everything.
Culture, I guess.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And belief system. So, you've been in this location here in L.A. for 20-plus years then?
Well, this is a relatively new shop. I've only been here 7 years.
Oh.
But down the street, I was in that shop for 42 years.
Larger or smaller?
About the same size, yeah. And so I've been doing it a long time.
Yeah. And Jeff's been with you. He's a kind of young guy. Looks like he hasn't been here probably that long.
No, he's been here maybe 8 years.
Okay, yeah. And who else have you had working with you in the past as far as builders? Anybody who's gone on, I mean, to work in other places?
No, but the you know, a lot of wonderful guys that have gone on to do other things, whether it was playing the violin to one of them became a very good violin maker, and and painters and you know, the other way that they go to art school and get the master's in and then they come to work here and then they end up house painters. So it's there's a lot of delusion in an artist's life. You know, you plan on it's that's I taught for a while, I remember, and I thought that was one of the big failures of our school system is not preparing them for the world when they get out of school. You know, they teach them to be an artist, a painter, or a or something like that, where they can paint pretty pictures. But boom, once you're out of here, how do you make a living?
Yeah, they can't balance a checkbook, basically, even.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Are there some magicians that are your favorites today? I mean, that's maybe a hard question, which you like a lot of people, and you build things for a lot of, are there some people, living or dead, that you really particularly admire?
Well, yeah, I always loved Doug Henning's performances, and Norm Nielsen's his act was wonderful, and of course Siegfried and Roy, the spectacle of all that. Yeah, and there's
three different styles there completely.
Yeah, there's so many of them that and the close up guys up there. You know, I'm very poor at card manipulation and card tricks. Those guys fool me all the time.
Yeah.
And it's a great feeling to be cool, I think.
I think that's why some magicians are into magic, so this way that they can try to experience that, that feeling. I would imagine if someone was hooked on some sort of drugs or something, that you have to have a bigger high all the time, as I say, I would think. And so, like with magicians, that it's like, okay, I got to see more magic, so this way maybe I can eventually be fooled again and remember that time with the first time that I saw that ball and vase, you know,
yeah, that feeling.
That feeling. That's why I try and recapture that feeling. And sometimes it gets harder and harder. Whenever I watch a magic show, I try to go and attend as if that I am just seeing it for the first time.
Yes.
And with people sitting around me who know I'm a magician, how do you do that? I don't know. I would rather just be completely fooled and not know sometimes.
Right. I love that feeling. And I don't want to know. I mean,
Well, that's another thing too. You know, there are some things that I know that I'll never do. For an example, the first time I saw Siegfried and Roy and whatever that they had, the Lynette Chappell, I think, had appeared above the stage in the glass, you know, and then they pulled the thing up and then the tiger appeared in the thing. I thought, that's fantastic. And I really don't want to know how, I got an idea, what I think, how it happened, but I really don't want to think too much into it. I'd rather just remember that moment because I'll never be doing that. I'm not going to have a tiger. I'm not going to be having a large stage show. So I'm not going to try to dissect it. Now, if there's a particular trick I see that a close-up magician is doing, and I'm thinking, oh, I think I really like that. I might be able to dissect that and change that around a little bit, put a different presentation into it, and I think I can do it, and I'll try to maybe recreate something different from that based upon that. You know, Alan Wakeling had something that was in his book, and it impressed me, and I took that idea and made something else from it. I wrote to Jim Steinmeier, I think was one who had written the book about Alan Wakeling, and he said, well, I have coffee with him regularly. I'll ask him if it's okay if you market this thing. And he did, and he said, yeah, this is significantly different enough, and so go ahead and market it, and you've got rights to that, and just send him some cash, and I did. And so it's all, you know, well and good, but it was something that I saw that I wanted to add my improvement onto this. And I think that's important, that we just not stagnate and let magic be as it is, that you have to kind of build on that by seeing something
else.
Put
your own personality into it and twist. Yeah. And, you know, we were talking about the automaton chess player, originally built in 1769. And it's so many people think that the magic is just in the prop, and the magician is so secondary. Well, in the chess player over here, you know, half if not more of the presentation is in the man presenting it, and his misdirection and what he's doing makes it into a wonderful illusion. And I've always said that you know, I build these things, but I used to build violins years and years ago, and I can build a nice violin, but I sure can't play it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like the what I build here. I can build them, but I can't perform them. It takes a special person, mm-hmm. you know, to have the knack to get out there and make it sing.
Right. Well, that was something I remember Bob Lund was saying in a lecture one time about that there are different people who have certain compartments, I guess, they're really good at. And he said, I am just a protector and curator of things. He said, a real magician is someone who is actually performing. He said, collectors are collectors, and there are performers who perform. And they like magic, but they're not both really, in my opinion, I don't consider myself a magician because, he said, I don't perform. You know, I collect books and all these other kinds of things, you know. So everybody has their own special thing. There are a lot of rooms in this house, you know, basically.
Yes, that's well put.
Yeah. Well, as we kind of start to wrap up, I appreciate it. And have there been any, significant things that have happened in magic, aside from what we just talked about, I guess, changing from mechanics to electronics to computer? Is there anything else that you kind of are seeing the future of magic going towards, or as far as building new illusions that we're going towards?
Boy, that's... we're in an age right now with all the, you know, the electronics and YouTubes, and mm-hmm. it seems like every 6 months something new comes on the market, and that here in the Hollywood area, there's so many talented people that were involved in special effects and in creating things, and now their jobs are wiped out because it's all done with computer-generated mm-hmm. graphics,
CGI,
and so I hope the magician can stay ahead of the curve there. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems kind of hard because your audience can Google up what you're doing.
True enough.
You know, and it's kind of scary. So
during your show, even
I think it's tough, but the magicians that I know, they're very clever people, and mm-hmm. I'm sure they'll do it.
Well, and to wrap up, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. So I always like to ask my guests, what is your magic word? It could be a word, a phrase, something that's important to you. I don't necessarily mean like abracadabra or something, but something that is your motto, your life creed, something that is important to you. Or,
well, let's see. Of course, I had a bird that was here. And his name was Maxie. And I had him. He died when he was 80 years old, and he was around here forever. But I remember the guy I looked up to the most. He was a builder, but he was a builder of furniture. And he used to say that, you know, John, if there's ever a question of success, you look to your work for the answer. And so I kind of stuck to that.
Mm-hmm. Good. So, yeah, look to your work for the answer to success.
Yeah.
I like that. That provokes some good thinking right there. Good. Well, listen, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you, Scott.
I appreciate it a lot. I'm going to take a couple of pictures and maybe a little video I can put on the blog so
people
can go back over and watch this then a little bit later. So I really want to thank you so very, very much. It's been wonderful speaking to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, John. For the Magic Word Podcast, that was Johnny Gaughan. This is Scotty out. During my time with John Gaughan, I was in complete awe spending one-on-one time with his undivided attention, and he was so open and wonderful to talk to about his life and his craft. He was such a wonderful, hospitable gentleman, and I will forever be indebted to him for giving me this special time that we could spend together. Indeed, this will be one of my most memorable experiences behind the microphone on The Magic Word. Regardless of how much you may have enjoyed this podcast, I am sure that my enjoyment of actually being there was twice as exciting. Thank you, John, so very, very much for your time and your friendship. And I would not have thought to set up this interview had it not been for a suggestion from one of my listeners. Within this past year, I received an email from a listener who said that if I ever had an opportunity to chat with John, then I should take the time to record something. Of course, I could have recorded a chat over Skype or the telephone, but it just wouldn't have been the same as actually being there. So, I am thankful that chance and opportunity aligned while I was in Los Angeles when we both could get together for this podcast. Sometimes it really is magic. If you have any suggestions for interviews, then please drop me an email at scott
themagicwordpodcast.com, or you can leave a comment on the blog at themagicwordpodcast.com. Of course, you can leave a comment or join the conversation on our Facebook page at facebook.com/themagicwordpodcast. So, until next time, stay well, get booked, and please signal when changing lanes. This is Scotty out.